Sooner than that, we have concerts happening this weekend, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon, as we've been mentioning all week, of the Spokane Symphony opening its season. And it is the conclusion of what we call Symphony Week. James Loback, good morning, James.
How are you
been? And a pleasure once again that we get to be in the same room together. And in the adjacent room, just about to play for us, is Bella Ristova, this violinist. And, you know, violinists, they're so fascinating to encounter. Had you encountered her at all in any professional way prior to yesterday?
Only by name. Only by name. I know the orchestra had been trying to book her for years, actually, and we finally managed it, and then COVID took care of that. So actually, it's great that she's the first soloist in for the restart.
Well, we're going to go, she's going to introduce herself, as the way she should, with her violin, and we're going to hear the first two movements of the D minor partita of Bach, and then we will find out about her, and then from her and James, we're certainly going to find out about Sibelius. So let's go to our studio.
Thank you.
Live in our studio, the first two movements of the Bach D minor Partita, played for us by the violinist Bella Hristova, who is the soloist on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon's concert with the Sibelius Violin Concerto, which she will be doing in the concert conducted by James Lowe, and which will be opening with a piece by Adolphus Hellstork, and then concluding with the Brahms Second Symphony, all of which we will get a good chance to talk about in the course of this hour, as we're in the final hour of Symphony Week. So, Bella, thank you.
Oh, pleasure.
What a treat to have you do that.
I'm struggling with the chair.
It's a squeaky chair. Find a way to somehow be comfortable, and we can hear you just
fine.
I'm good. Okay, good. And so, when did you first take on any part of the D minor Partita?
Oh,
in your life, was it way back?
Yeah, probably when I was a student at Curtis at the Curtis Institute, maybe my second or third year.
Sure, and is it different to take on that one because of the elephant in the room because of the chaconne that's at the end? Do you kind of wait longer to take on that one or what?
No, I don't know what order I learned the Bach sonatas and partitas in. But, if I had to pick a piece to practice for the rest of my life, it would be the chaconne.
Of course.
And maybe maybe I'm not alone in that. But this is probably the partita that I've played the most. Mm-hmm. Again, maybe because of the chaconne.
Well, sure. Well, it works because there's this wonderful document to do.
I mean, it's longer than the first four movements combined.
Yeah.
I think it's a never-ending journey just practicing all of the Bach works.
Well, yeah, and so talk even about the two movements you played just now. Who was your teacher at Curtis when you started this?
Ida Kavafi.
Ida, okay.
Yeah.
And so what do you feel about the journey you've taken even on the shorter movements of the D minor Partita?
I feel like it's always different. I'm always trying to hear something new in the music or just, I don't try to plan too much the shape that I'm going to do or the phrasing. I do try to do different things in the repeats. But I kind of let the moment take it away.
And that must be a nice thing about this stage of your career, because it's probably past worrying about your third finger is going to be.
Right. Well, I worry about that, too.
but no, so that you can deal with the moment and use different parts of yourself and your brain when you come back to these?
Exactly. Yeah, I feel like I put in the practice for it. And then in performance, I try to forget about that and just think about the music.
Yeah. Bella Hristova from Bulgaria.
Yes.
And I guess the quick political story, or was, did you leave Bulgaria? What part of changes within that country?
Oh, I was born in communism,
uh-huh.
But I left past when it fell. So it fell in 89.
Oh, so you were there when it was.
I was four, yeah.
Okay.
And so I left Bulgaria when I was 13.
Okay.
And came to the States to study.
To the States. And was it simply the wonderful opportunities of what can happen in what was available here?
Yeah, I think so. My mother always had a dream that her daughter would be a concert violinist. Like from age six, that's what was told to me. You're going to be a concert violinist. But I think she knew that I had to leave Bulgaria to have more opportunities and better study opportunities. So that's just how it went.
And with a mother that knew that from age six, you came out as a whole person.
Well, that's the face I put on anyway.
Perfect. And so the journey, was it directly to Curtis that you came?
No, I actually went to high school in Michigan. I went to a Steiner school there, wonderful school.
Oh, Rudolf Steiner, the how do you describe him, the biodynamic, super environmental, interesting. Well, that alone must have been a fascinating kind of diversion into a different thought and culture.
It was. It also helped me learn English, because when I came here, I didn't speak English at age 13. So they were wonderful to me. I, I started eighth grade, and it was a small class. So I had spent 2 months prior at a music camp. So I watched the Indiana Jones movies over and over, and I think that helped me pick up English. And I watched a lot of television in my first few years here.
Well, it's a logical way to do it. Yeah. You know, just to do that. Well, good for you. And then as your career really emerged, was it through competitions, or what was your path into rising above, you know, all of the many fabulous violinists around?
Yeah. I mean, I did a few competitions. I won one competition in New Zealand, the Michael Hill International Violin Competition. And, you know, that gave a lot of wonderful opportunities. There's a cash prize, there's a recording. But for me, the most invaluable part of that was a winner's tour the following year. It was toured New Zealand. It was a concert tour, something like 15 or 16 concerts in the span of a month. And that really shows you whether you can do what you signed up for or not.
Sure, because every night another small town.
And, right, and that was a transformative experience for me.
Yeah, and all the cliches we feel about New Zealand, you must have a lot of lovely personal stories of that time.
Oh, sure.
You?
That's my favorite place in the world.
Yeah, I mean, certainly during the pandemic, they showed that they had a cohesive civilization,
yes.
Didn't they?
Which a lot of empathy for others.
Yeah, which would be pretty wonderful. But here you are. You live in America, and you make your living as a concert violinist. And I have reason to believe that it may be both artistic and personal that you have some particular affinities to modern music.
Oh, well, I do. I'm married to a composer.
Is that a cause or an effect?
It's an effect because I love contemporary music. You know, I would give anything to be able to talk to Beethoven, but obviously we can't. And I love performing new works. I love talking to composers and having works written for me. I just think it's part of our jobs as instrumentalists to continue the birth of new repertoire. And that's just what performers have done throughout history. So...
For years and years, we had the pleasure of Gunther Schuller making Spokane his third home, almost.
Right.
He spent about 25 years of the last part of his life here, and so we got to know him well. And I've thought a lot about composers. Do they perceive music differently? Can you ask your husband something about music that he would kind of answer from a different vantage point than James Lowe might?
You know, I don't know. We don't talk a whole lot about music, but David hears things kind of in an amazing way. Sometimes if he's further along writing a piece, he'll try and play something from the piano. He'll be like, and over here, this is going to go like that. And over here, this is going to go like that. And I have no clue what he's talking about, but he hears it all in his head. So, yeah, I think there's a bigger picture view on music than maybe I would have.
Yeah, it does seem like that their brains work differently.
Totally.
in some way. But you're here to play Sibelius, and so let's double down on Sibelius and certainly invite James into the conversation. What's your history with Sibelius Concerto?
Sibelius might be one of the first violin concertos that I heard a recording of. It was a voice track playing when I was little.
Oh, okay.
On an old LP, and I remember there was a part in the third movement where we had to stop and turn it over. So I've always loved this piece very, very much. I probably also learned it for the first time when I was at Curtis, and I've played it a lot. It's really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it never gets easier, but I think it's one of the most beautiful and rewarding violin concertos.
Talk about kind of how it's different in some ways in its approach and what it does and how it's built than maybe the traditional 19th century concertos that went before it.
Right. Well, it is written in the 20th century, very early, but it's a 20th century work. How it's different is that it is written with these lush harmonies and you want to emote kind of 100% of the time, but he actually puts in sort of barriers for you to do that because he marks a lot of poco fortes, which is sort of a restrained dynamic. I don't think wants it to be peaking all the time. So the challenge is to really find those peaks and pull back the rest of the time. So that I remind myself of that constantly while I'm on stage. Be like, no, not yet. Yeah. Save it for the really big moment. He sort of writes that in.
And James, you and Bella worked on this yesterday. And so how do you feel kind of about Sibelius and this piece and this sense of restraint?
Well, we were talking about this before, and it's always lovely when you meet a soloist, you have exactly the same idea about a piece of music. It's always comforting. You know, I worked in Finland for a long time. My conducting teacher is Jorma Panula Finn, and I had an orchestra there. And there's something I think about the Finnish character, which is that they're quite taciturn. They don't speak a lot. They don't do small talk. They do big talk. The emotion there, it's very contained, and then it explodes. So it's a very, and I kind of, as a Brit, I kind of understand that little bit of suppressing emotion. I think that's also my character a bit too. So Sibelius has always been a composer I felt very kind of emotionally attached to and very close to. But I think Bella's exactly right. This whole thing of it's like, he screams in quiet dynamics sometimes, and it's really, really kind of suppressed. And then there are these moments where it just bursts out, and it's wonderful. And I think the trick is, as Bella said, if you can contain these places and then find those one or two moments in the whole piece where it really goes bananas, then that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, and a great moment of containment is simply to create the atmosphere in the bed in the first few bars.
Yeah, it is. And it actually, I shouldn't say these things before a performance, but it is, I think, it's one of the harder concertos for everybody on stage. It's, you know, there are a lot of concertos where the soloist does all the heavy lifting and the conductor just kind of helps a little bit and the orchestra just plays and it's great. But for the Sibelius, it really is that the orchestra writing is hard, the coordination is hard, it's very intricate, it's a big jigsaw puzzle. And you've got all of that, and you have to create these atmospheres that are very delicate and subtle. It's a tricky piece, but when it works, oh my goodness me, it really is one of the best concertos in the repertoire.
You know, if you don't mind, because you suggested you might be able to do this if we give you plenty of time to get out there and pick up your violin and make sure it's in tune and stuff. Yeah, you're willing to play the opening for
us? Yes, I would love to.
Oh, that would be great. You want to say anything about it, or just do it?
Well, it's, you know, some people think of this opening as icy, but he marks espressivo, so I think it's an entrance, but I think it's a restrained espressivo. So when I play it, I try not to, you know, have too big of a romantic vibrato. Yeah. So it's expressive, but with something left for later.
Well, let's ask you to demonstrate that, Bella Hristova, who's the violin soloist for the Sibelius Concerto, which there have been so many famous recordings of it. The really fast one that was done by the famous violinist from California that lived in California. You know, with all the technique, the matinee idol. Him, who was considered kind of an icy performer too, but with the extraordinary technique. Oh, I don't know why I'm going blank on his name, but anyway, I'm mostly just killing time so that Bella can be ready to do this for us. So back to the studio, and after the strings have laid down just a wonderful bed of sound, here comes the violin. Thank you. opening of the Sibelius Violin Concerto, Bella Hristova, will continue from that point on when the concert proceeds on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. And both James and I were kind of, I think, mentally singing the clarinet entrance and the other thing that that goes along. As then, because it is marvelous how, even within what we just heard, the other things sneak in and build organically, don't they?
It is, and it's not a concerto where the soloist is separate from the orchestra.
My turn.
Exactly. Yes, it's not one of those pieces. It's integrated, and you see this. I think even at the end, you know, there's the cadenza in the first movement where the solo violinist just plays on her own, and then when you emerge out of it, you don't really realize it. But the way the orchestra comes back in, you're halfway through that theme before you realize that the orchestra is almost playing. It's incredible. It's this really intertwined way that he writes for the instrument that is really astonishing.
Yeah, which really makes it, and that's a real pleasure with a concerto, isn't it? When you reel, then everybody on stage is in the same place.
Yeah, and you have to have really like ears on stalks as a player in the orchestra when you're playing this piece, because there are so many little things that have to line up and fit together in this jigsaw puzzle. And he does these crazy things where he has the places where the soloist is playing in fours and the orchestra's playing in sixes and they swap over, and it's an astonishing structure that he builds. But you know, all of that, you really don't notice any of this intricacy of technique, because the music is so emotional and so expressive that all of this really clever stuff, a bit like Brahms actually, it's kind of by the by. It makes it feel really solid and really work. But you're not sitting there thinking, oh, that's the third theme coming back again, hidden in the clarinet. Doesn't work like that.
Yeah, no, it's so organic that way. And Bella, thank you for doing that. Is this one of your early concerts out of the pandemic? Or have you been able to do a few things over the last few months?
I performed, yes, in the spring. It's my first concert with a full orchestra. Mm-hmm. The things I've done have been with chamber orchestra, a lot of Vivaldi Four Seasons. And some chair music concerts over the summer. But yeah, this was the first full orchestra last night. It really felt beautifully overwhelming.
it would, yeah.
To have that sound all around you again.
To appreciate that again. And then and talk just a little bit more about a piece that your husband's writing a concerto for you. It's written.
Mm-hmm. He wrote that, and it was... We've performed at many places now. It was co-commissioned by 8 different orchestras across the U.S., and is a violin concerto for violin full orchestra. He based it on the idea of marriage, because it was around the time that we got married. It's not necessarily autobiographical, he says, but he has hidden little Easter eggs throughout. And one of the most special ones is, my father was also a composer. He was a Russian composer, and I unfortunately didn't know him because he passed away when I was young. So he has a violin concerto. And David took 13 measures from his violin concerto and put it in our violin concerto's slow movement, which is meant to be the ceremony part of the marriage. So it was just a beautiful surprise that he put in there for me. But it's a great work.
Wow.
And I'm playing it twice this season.
Okay, with
Symphony Tacoma and Buffalo Philharmonic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did see the thing where Symphony Tacoma talked about having had to delay it.
Yeah, that was a delayed, actually, but... No, that was a delayed one. Buffalo was going to be this season.
Oh, okay. And is Joanne Folletta conducting
the
Buffalo?
We did in Hawaii together, the David's concerto.
So that's a wonderful. Well, Bella Hristova, thank you. Thank you for
such
being here.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And so now let's turn to Brahms. And so if you suddenly have to inject something into our Brahms discussion, please do. James, seems like I'm hearing a lot of Brahms lately. The Eroica Trio played Brahms on Monday night here in town, and there's been seemingly a little bit more from the performance things on the radio. Is it the obvious that that's the warmth and the comfort and the relief we need in our lives right now?
I think it is. I think it's also complicated because, you know, with Brahms, the warmth and the comfort is never entirely wholly one thing. There's always a little bit of melancholy in there, and I think that's probably why we're drawn to it right now. there's a kind of a bittersweet feeling. I always feel that with Brahms, it's not unhappy music, but it's happiness observed very often. It's like he as a composer is watching people being happy. And there's this quality in his music. And I think, yeah, right now, that's we've got a lot of complex emotions going on. So music that has shaded emotion, I think, is probably what we need.
You usually come out of a discussion with you with a brand new thought. So thank you for that brand new thought, because it really is a good one. I mean, one can even do the overly obvious and project into he and the Schumanns for the maybe complexity of his own life and his own personality, because he wasn't just your average. Well, I don't know. I mean, talk a little bit more about Brahm, what he was or wasn't in terms of his character.
Well, I think it's really interesting. It's very telling. You know, he didn't marry. He never had kids. But it's clear, you know, he looked after the Schumann's children when poor old Robert was in the asylum and Clara was off giving concerts to earn money. He had an apartment above the Schumann's, and I wouldn't quite say he was their babysitter, but he was keeping an eye on the children, which is an astonishing thought.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you listen to the Second Symphony and there's that beautiful second subject with the cellos and the violas, with the violas underneath the cellos, and it's this kind of almost exactly note-for-note minor key version of the lullaby, the child's lullaby that he wrote, I think that's a really key component to unlocking, for me, what I understand the meaning of the symphony to be. And like I say, it's not an unhappy piece at all. But there are a couple of moments, and in the third movement too, there's this beautiful moment when there's this very simple childlike melody going on, and then right at the end, the violins play this most heartbreaking and tender little comment over the top, and it just finishes, and the whole piece just kind of is like, well, that's the way it is. So I think for me that this this relationship, and obviously, you know, when you read the letters between Clara Schumann and Brahms, they were in love, and apparently Robert said before he died to Johannes Brahms, please look after, marry Clara, and they never did. And I think there's something in this thing about this tension in him of love and family. And as I say, it's not unhappy music at all, but it always feels to me, this symphony, that he's watching something from the outside a little bit.
Yeah, nice. Brahms' Second Symphony, which will be on the second half of the Saturday night, Sunday afternoon concert. And let us not ignore the Hail Stork, because again, the Eroica Trio, they played their first performance ever of a Hail Stork trio that had just been written, which was crazy, crazy, crazy complex rhythms, 5/8, 7/8, 11/8, everything just going on top of each other, and the audience just loved it. It wasn't kind of a forbidding exercise at all, but it really delivered a lot of stuff. So tell me about programming Hail Stork at all, and about him.
Well, I think he's going through a kind of renaissance period now, which I think is wonderful. It's long overdue. I think he just turned 80 last year, I'm right in saying. It is a great piece of music that we're playing. And I think the reason I programmed it, the whole program I wanted is going on a bit of a journey. I think post-COVID we needed some kind of musical journey that helped us heal a little bit. So I wanted to start with this fanfare on Amazing Grace, because frankly, I feel we need to acknowledge the grace that has got us all to this side of our history right now. You know, the orchestra is still here. We're all good. And I think to kind of acknowledge that is appropriate. And I think with that tune, it's embedded in everyone. Everybody knows that tune. It's probably one of the most famous tunes on the planet. And I think that's a really nice way of acknowledging. And when I discovered this piece of his, I knew the second I heard it that that's how we had to start. I think generally, you know, he's being played a lot now, and I'm really grateful for that. He treads this wonderfully fine line between being really emotionally connective and not dumbing down, which I think it's a really, as a composer, that's the challenge nowadays, is how you can actually write in a way that's modern and but still connects emotionally to people.
But that's very much your job, to be finding those people, to really keep music alive, as with an expanding audience. So it's not just for the esoteric or the insiders.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the best parts of my job, actually, being a bit of a, you know, taking a I wouldn't call myself a musical pioneer at all, but, you know, exploring different repertoire. I mean, mm-hmm. later in the season, we have a great piece by Anna Klein called Dance for Cello, and I've known Anna for years. We were at university together, and I heard that piece, and the second I heard it, I thought, I have to program this immediately. So we're doing it in our third concert. But bringing these pieces here is a real joy. Also discovering little gems that, you know, we're playing some Beethoven that nobody plays.
The Beethoven next. Program is, and we'll let's not give away too much about what we're going to talk about, but it's not just the same old tunes.
No, and I love doing that. I love finding hidden gems from well-known composers, mm-hmm. hidden gems from really, you know, unknown composers. We're playing some Cherepnin later in the season. An astonishingly beautiful piece of music that should be played, you know, on every radio station three times a day. It's just got everything. And so for me, this joy of really digging in, finding new pieces, contemporary and old, and trying to weave them all together into some coherent whole, it's one of the most enjoyable parts of my job.
Absolutely. Well, and it begins Saturday night at 8 o'clock, Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, and... I'm sure you've heard it around the edges. What at this moment? What are the rules? Vax cards or what? What can you definitively say about these things?
So for the audience, entry to the Fox will be proof of vaccination or proof of a negative test.
Mm-hmm. Within 48 hours.
I believe within 48 hours.
Yeah, something like that.
So. The best place to go is our website. It always has the latest stuff, but that's proof of vaccination or
and then what's the mask decision
at
this point?
It is, as within all kind of indoor gatherings right now per CDC guidelines, so masked at all times unless you're actively taking a drink.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that is the overview of that, and as you say, the website, which can illuminate any of those things. Well, what a treat! Thank you for everything and for your return, and thank you for getting here to see us. But we finally got Bella here to have with us. Thank you.
Thank you.